And Ms. Tyson. Y'all take a minute to get settled in and go ahead and sign the sheet if you haven't already signed the sheet.
Do you want us to do that now?
Yes, please, go ahead. Yeah, we're a little ahead of schedule, so. Thank you, Kim. All right, Mr. Bledsoe, you have 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Okay, you have 15 minutes. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. The threshold question here, obviously, is was the evidence properly admitted in the circuit court? The Commonwealth points to Garnett versus Commonwealth. Where this
was referred to as the text from the phone, is that it?
Correct, Your Honor. Texts and
on the same page here.
Texts and tweets, and I'll probably just refer to them as texts.
Messages, okay. That's fine.
Texts or messages to keep things simple. But Commonwealth points to Garnett, where this court, in an unpublished opinion, determined that proximity alone wasn't enough to determine that the text messages actually came from the defendant. Bearing in mind that in that case, the question wasn't, did the defendant own the phone?
Well, here there's no issue about the ownership of the phone, is there?
No, there is not, Your Honor.
So it's his phone, and these messages are on it, and I believe the testimony, the expert testimony, was that these were messages that were sent, not messages that were received. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
If that's the case, why doesn't that fit the classic party admission exception to the hearsay rule?
Well, the question, of course, is, was there someone else who had access to the telephone?
No. Not who had access. In other words, if it's your phone, and I'm talking about for admissibility purposes now, all the Commonwealth has to do to establish a foundation is a circumstantial case, if you will, that you're the author of the messages that go out on your phone. And while it's possible someone else can borrow your phone and send a message, that is an argument that can certainly be made at the appropriate time, but it doesn't defeat necessarily a foundational requirement, does it?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that it does. If you look at the factors cited in Garnett from the Mississippi Supreme Court case that this court cited in Garnett as a basis for authentication of the messages, none of those factors is ownership alone of the telephone. So I would suggest, Your Honor, that the question of who sent the messages isn't established necessarily by the ownership of the telephone. Now, if the court says that ownership of the telephone in this case is sufficient, then obviously there isn't an error of law, and that pretty much ends the inquiry.
And let me ask you, just for clarification purpose, counsel, it's my understanding from your argument that you're challenging the admissibility, the foundation piece, and your discussion about hearsay is only as it relates to the foundation, not as a separate challenge to the hearsay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. Thank you. I'm glad that was clear. So the same question that we have here is, did the Commonwealth establish by preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard for admissibility, did the Commonwealth establish that Atkins sent the messages simply by ownership of the telephone? And it isn't uncommon for someone to let another person use his own telephone, whether it's a family member or a close friend. In Garnett, whether he owned the telephone or not, he easily could have been a person who had access to the phone and used the phone.
Well, the trial objection was that it was hearsay. Is that correct?
Both foundation and hearsay, Your Honor.
Well, at least as to the photo of the money machine, I gathered the only objection was it's hearsay. I know there's another objection as to the...
And I think that I think the point on the photographs was conceded at trial, Your Honor. I wasn't trial counsel, but that was conceded at trial, that the photographs, because they are photographs, were not statements and were not hearsay.
Okay.
The argument you're making is foundational, admissibility of the messages, the tweet and the other messages, based on an inadequate foundation, since your position is that the only thing we have is that it was his phone.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, there were no statements at any point that no one else used the phone. He was never questioned about that, or at least that's not in evidence if that occurred.
Is it significant that the phone was password protected and he did give the officers the password?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, certainly, again, anyone who, if he's letting someone else use his phone, he can certainly have given them the password as well. So the question, again, still is, where is the point between Garnett and Tuning?
Well, if the standard is preponderance, and and the Commonwealth could certainly establish it circumstantially, from a narrow foundational standpoint, I guess I get back to my original point, which is, what more do they need to do? I mean, there may be an explanation. Your client may have an explanation, or he may not. But what more need they do than to establish that it's his phone? I mean, we all have our personal phones these days, and I think the average person knows that. While certainly I can borrow Judge Decker or Judge O'Brien's phone, or they could borrow mine, that does occur. Nonetheless, in the absence of any evidence to that effect, we generally presume that anything that's on the phone, especially if it's behind a password protection, is personal to the individual who's the owner of the phone.
Well, and again, I'll go back to those seven factors that were cited in Garnett from the Mississippi Supreme Court case. Some of those were things like evidence from phone records that would establish that the phone was being used at a time when no one else but the owner would have had the opportunity to use the phone, and admission that that the person who owned the phone sent the tweets or texts, sent the messages.
Now, let me stop you there, though. That can be proven by circumstantial evidence, correct? So the fact that the money counter was found in the appellant's room, and the money counter was part of the discussion in the text messages, would that be circumstantial evidence to support that he sent those messages?
You could just as well assume. Well, and that gets into a couple other questions too, Your Honor, not the least of which is, since there were two different theories of guilt here, whether he was simply in possession of stolen property or whether he was the person who committed the burglaries and the grand larcenies.
The trier of fact resolved that, correct?
But again, we're not arguing about that, as I understand. I thought we'd all agreed that the only issue was whether the foundational issue, whether it should have been admitted.
Well, I think
whether there's an explanation for it or whatever, that's for later. We're not that's after it's admitted, and that's basically a jury argument essentially. How much weight to give it given these circumstances, that sort of thing. The question is. As I understand it, at least, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood the question before us to be, and before the trial court to be, given that the evidence was that this is his phone, it's got these texts and these pictures on it, the money counter's found in his room, given the totality of those circumstances, was that sufficient foundation for the information that's on the phone to be admitted to be considered by the fact finder for any purpose?
And I guess I'm saying the same thing again, Your Honor. We don't know who took the pictures. We don't know who sent the text messages.
It's true. We don't know that. But the question simply being where it is. In other words, if I have a safe deposit box or I have a safe in my home and the police get a search warrant for it, I have the combination or I open it for them, and inside are these incriminating photographs, is that sufficient to lay a foundation even though others might have had access to that safe?
I think I'm still in the same place, Your Honor, that if the court decides that the evidence that the Commonwealth presented was sufficient, and my argument is simply that it wasn't, again, that this falls somewhere between Garnett and Tuning, and that's the primary question with respect to the admissibility of these photos, or rather the texts and messages. So if the court doesn't decide or if the court decides that that is an error, then there's a move on to a harmless error analysis. If the court decides that that's not an error, then in spite of the language in Garnett, then again, there's no other analysis necessary, really. So that brings me back to Tuning. And again, in Tuning, what was actually the issue there is he actually admitted to having sent those messages, which is an entirely different matter. And again, that's why I said that this falls somewhere in between those two cases.
Counsel, I want to just make sure I understand your harmless error argument. You recognize, if we say that it was properly admitted, then we don't go that next step. But let's assume we say it was not, and we go to the harmless error. Explain your resolution of the code section, the post-Rushing code section, and the harmless error analysis.
Well, there are two sentences in that statute that create tests, if I'm reading it correctly, one of which says that all the evidence at trial will be considered in determining the sufficiency of the evidence, whether properly admitted or not. If there were not an error of law, that test then serves to determine, because now the question simply becomes sufficiency of the evidence, that test serves to determine only if the person remains guilty, only if the defendant remains guilty. But if there is an error, and that error is determined to be harmless, then that question becomes an entirely different test. And as in Garnett, it becomes a test to determine if the defendant can be retried. It's not. It's not like that test, that sentence about considering all of the evidence is the be-all and end-all to the question, which I think is what the Commonwealth is arguing, essentially, that, hey, since there's sufficient evidence to convict him, he has to stay convicted. That second or that last sentence about the harmless error is a separate test that still has to be performed if there's an error. And if the error is harmless, then the only question is that remains is whether or not he can be retried. So,
there's no sufficiency argument here. I mean, there's no sign of error given insufficient matter of law there. I thought it was just the admissibility with the harmless
error. There's no sufficiency argument in your assignment of error.
My assignment of error was that the evidence was improperly admitted, and right. Without that evidence, the evidence was insufficient.
Well, see, but that's controlled by statute, and that's not the standard that we would apply.
Perhaps I wasn't imaginative enough in drafting it and saying that it was not a harmless error in my...
Well, no.
But I think the two arguments are the same thing.
Yeah, if it's harmless error, then we're done. So even assuming that there's error. If it's not harmless error, it's based on, the error would be based on the abuse of discretion in admitting the evidence, correct? And the remedy for that is to remand for a new trial. The only double jeopardy implication would be if the evidence was legally insufficient as a matter of law. And when we consider legal insufficiency, we're required to consider even improperly admitted evidence.
Correct, Your Honor. And perhaps I was misunderstanding the question. But
I just want to make sure you understood that you didn't make a separate sufficiency argument.
Correct. I did not make an argument that he could not have been convicted of anything.
Okay.
In fact, I believe I conceded that he...
If you prevailed, the only thing that's going to happen is another trial.
Correct.
Okay.
And in fact, I think I conceded that that the evidence would have been sufficient for the possession...
You did too.
for the possession of stolen property. And again, I didn't do this till my reply brief, and probably could have done it sooner and should have done it sooner, but the possession of burglary tools conviction is out of the picture as well. So then the question becomes on the harmless error, what did the Commonwealth get out of, if there was an error, what did they get out of this error? Obviously, as I pointed out, they advanced the presumption from recent possession of stolen goods from a week afterwards to the day after the burglaries. A bunch of incriminating statements that may not have even been made by the defendant, and the opportunity in both their closing argument and their rebuttal closing argument to beat on the fact that these statements were incriminating. And I think that pretty much covers it, unless you all
Thank
have
you,
more
counsel.
Questions. Thank you.
Ms. Tyson, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. I think that we agree on some things today, my opposing counsel and I, and that would be that the underlying facts that the trial court looks to in making a determination about admissibility, the standard of proof on that is preponderance of the evidence. And once that threshold is met, once the trial judge makes that determination that the evidence is admissible, then the fact finder is going to determine the weight of the evidence.
And well, it has to be relevant to be admissible.
Absolutely.
That's the test. And here the alleged relevance is this is his phone and therefore his messages.
Yes, that's correct.
Essentially. And your opponent suggests that's insufficient as a matter of law to establish relevance.
And I would disagree with that, but also add that we have a little bit more than it's just his phone, and we have a little bit more than it's just he gave them the password. In addition to having the photograph of the money counter that is later discovered in his bedroom, the special agent testified, I believe this is at page 182 of the appendix, when asked that his name is actually in an email in the on the phone. It is 182. He's asked the question if there's anything with the defendant's name on it by chance, and the answer is yes, it was an email address, and that had the defendant's name, yes. And then on recross, to be complete, apparently this was attached
this is a connection
to an app.
With the money counters, I
would I'm sorry?
This is a connection with a money counter?
I don't think so. I think this is maybe an app having to do with social media. But in any event, he has the photograph of the money counter that was taken, and of course the money counter is in his room. And the authenticity or the foundation in this case was satisfied.
Let me focus you, because
yes.
I understood your opponent to argue essentially that it's not enough, that it needed that someone else could have taken a picture of the money counter, someone else could have sent these text messages and Twitter tweets, and therefore what the Commonwealth did to establish relevancy was insufficient as a matter of law.
Well, I think he was saying, actually, I understood it to be that the foundation hadn't been laid because someone else could have done that. And he argued that this case falls between Garnett and Tuning, and I agree. I just think it falls a whole lot closer to Tuning than it does to Garnett. And the reason I say that is because in the Garnett case, we have someone who's in a car that he said he borrowed from his sister. And the police officer doesn't know where she got the phone, whether it was in the center console or whether it was from him. He makes no statement at all, and there is nothing to connect Garnett to the phone except proximity, and that's what this court said was insufficient. We have so much more than that in this case. Now, the trial judge here admitted that Tuning was somewhat stronger than the facts that we have here, because yes, in Tuning, the defendant admitted he sent the text message, but what we have here is possession of the phone. We have the password that's given by the defendant. His name is in the email with the app, however that is connected. We have the photograph of the money counter that's then found in his room. So there's so much more than mere proximity, which is what this court found was lacking in the Garnett case.
Was there anything in the record that would indicate anybody else had that phone?
No, I will tell you that the officer, I think this is maybe 159 to 160, did not remember where he got the phone in this case either. So there is that little piece. In fact, what he was asked was whether the phone had been taken from the defendant's backpack. And he said, I don't remember where I got it. But he was asked, did he say it was his? Yes. And he gave us the password so that then they got a search warrant, obviously, and went in from there. So this is between those two cases, but it is a whole lot closer to the Tuning case. And it is sufficient. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the threshold had been met. And therefore, the court did not err.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. So there would arguably be potential for others to have had access to that phone. Whose burden is it when you get to the question of admissibility versus the weight that's given to any piece of evidence? There was an opportunity to challenge the weight of the evidence, correct?
And, Your Honor, that challenge was made. I will tell you that the defendant asked Special Agent Brown, you can't say who sent this message. All you can say it was the phone. And then pages 212 to 213, it was actually argued in summation to the jury, to the fact finder, of we don't know exactly who sent this message. So the threshold.
So there was context in terms of
the. Yes,
the
fact finder was presented with that question, and the fact finder could have made a determination apart from the threshold of authenticity. To not give that any weight. The prosecutor did mention it in closing argument, but to sort of get over into hearsay just a little bit, that evidence was not admitted for the truth of the matter asserted. It was admitted to show that these texts were sent, that these statements were made. And I will say, with regard to harmless error, that should this court find that there's error, this error is harmless. It's the non-constitutional standard. I think this probably could meet even the constitutional standard because of the evidence that was presented in this case. This is the case where we've got three different places broken into at the same time. Two of the businesses share a building. The spark plug is found in the broken glass. And then a week later at 3 in the morning, the Henrico resident is over back in Powhatan, almost exactly where these businesses are. And when the car is stopped and there are four males in the car, just as there are on the surveillance videotape, and they look in his backpack, and in addition to his vocabulary homework, they find a spark plug, and they find all of the checks that had been written to the Arborscapes business from that Friday, and one of the cameras that had been stolen in his backpack. They find a pair of latex gloves within the car itself, in the back seat of the car. He's the front seat passenger. In the back seat of the car, they find a drill and masks and additional gloves. And then, of course, in his bedroom is one of the stolen money counters. And so the evidence, and I agree with the defendant that harmless error is not a question about sufficiency of the evidence. But harmless error, where the evidence is overwhelming, we meet that standard, that burden, that it did not affect the jury's verdict or the effect was but slight. Well, in this case, the evidence is overwhelming, irrespective of whether he sent out a text that said he was selling the money counter or that he wished he had kept the BMW or what have you. That in this case, obviously it's our position, the court did not err. And this court should find that there was no error. But even if this court were to find error, that error was absolutely harmless, and for either reason, this court should affirm the judgment of the Powhatan Circuit Court.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then the next case on the docket is